This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Margaret, we're at the home stretch in the health reform debate, and I think there's a renewed spirit of optimism in the air. President Obama is on the campaign trail again, talking directly to the American people in town hall settings across the country, laying out his vision and building public support for the final push.
That's right, Mark. And I thought the president had a tone of fearlessness and conviction in his voice when he spoke to a crowd of mostly college students at Arcadia University right outside Philadelphia on Monday. And I'm sure it's going to be the same spirit in St. Louis, where he's holding another rally. You know, it almost feels like all the anxiety over Republican Scott Brown winning the Massachusetts Senate seat and even the anxiety over the bipartisan summit a few weeks ago are a thing of the past.
It's cleared President Obama's mind, and he's made it clear this week that it's time for the endless debating to be over, and he's calling on Congress for a straight up or down vote.
And what a lot of confusion over that up or down vote there has been. So let's try and clarify it a little bit. There's been a lot of hoopla about the parliamentary procedure known as budget reconciliation, and the facts are a little bit different. What the House is working on is passing the current Senate bill. That bill was passed with 60 votes, not through reconciliation. The House now needs to pass it with a simple majority on a straight up or down vote. That's all that's required for any bill to pass the House. And if this happens, it will allow the bill to go on to the president to be signed into law.
Margaret, you're right on. The confusion about reconciliation is not on the main bill. That will be passed in the normal way. It will be on the amendment to the main bill after passage, which will require reconciliation, and again, only in the Senate, where they will be required to have 50-plus votes to get that bill passed. But we have to keep our eyes on the House, as the Democrats there need to pass the health care reform bill, and that's the challenge in front of us.
And I'm sure everyone's feeling the pressure. You know, I heard that Representative Joseph Gao of Louisiana, who was a guest here on Conversations back a few months ago, is going to vote no. He was the only Republican in the House of Representatives to vote for the health reform bill back in November. It's probably a measure of how difficult it is for them.
Speaking of guest Uwe Reinhardt, who spoke with us last week, wrote in his blog that he was a little depressed after the summit. He doesn't think policymakers or the public are ready for health reform because everyone's different vision of the ideal health systems are driven strictly by ideology. He writes, "I have seen efforts at health reform tumble into this ideological gulf, which has only grown wide over time. Health reform is likely to tumble into this ideological abyss in the future until one or the other ideology clearly triumphs in the political arena."
And we know the professor calls it as he sees it. We'll be keeping a close eye on the political arena in Washington to see if Congress can triumph and pass a health care reform bill and do it before the Easter break. We know that congressional procedures can be a doozy for people to understand, so we'll stay focused on giving our listeners the takeaway in this voting process. We hope we've been doing a good job of breaking down the health care reform debate. We know the truth requires much more explanation and in-depth analysis, and we'll do our very best to give you that. So please, if you have feedback, email us at conversations@chc1.com. We'd love to hear from you.
And speaking of the truth, I think our guest today can help us weed through some of this information so we can better understand this important order of business. We're happy to have Congressman John Dingell as our guest today. Congressman Dingell, who represents Michigan's 15th district, has fought long and hard for health reform. He's the longest serving member in the House of Representatives and is referred to as the Dean of the House. Congressman Dingell is a strong supporter of national health insurance.
No matter what the story, you can hear all of our shows at chcradio.com. We're happy to announce that Public Reality Radio in Grand Rapids, Michigan will start broadcasting our show, and we'll be keeping you posted. And you can subscribe to iTunes to get our show regularly downloaded. If you'd like to hang on to our every word and read a transcript of one of our shows, come visit us at chcradio.com. Now, before we speak with Congressman Dingell, let's check in with our producer, Lauren Bonner, with the headline news.
I'm Lauren Bonner with this week's headline news. In one final attempt to gain support for a healthcare overhaul, President Obama turned up the volume in his plea to the American people. At a rally at Arcadia University just outside of Philadelphia on Monday, President Obama told a crowd of mostly college students that healthcare reform can't wait. In the face of rising medical costs and plunging coverage, he said that Americans should not have to wait any longer for healthcare reform.
When's the right time for health insurance reform? Is it a year from now, or 2 years from now, or 5 years from now, or 10 years from now? I think it's right now, and that's why you're here today.
President Obama used the insurance industry as his main target, citing big rate increases on individual policies and saying his legislation would protect consumers from the worst practices by insurance companies.
There's no secret they're telling their investors this. We are in the money. We are going to keep on making big profits, even though a lot of folks are going to be put under hardship.
President Obama has made it clear that now is the time to act and that another year of negotiations would not help. He rejected repeated calls from Republicans to draft new legislation from scratch, and he made it clear last week that he will move forward on passing a health care bill without Republican support.
We are close, very close. So I ask Congress to finish its work. I ask them to give the American people an up or down vote.
President Obama did say, however, that he would include some Republican ideas in his proposed legislation, like funding state grants on medical malpractice reform and curbing waste, fraud, and abuse in the healthcare system. But before a final bill can be discussed, the House needs to approve the Senate healthcare bill passed in December. Obama would then sign it into law, and senators would promise to make changes on issues in the bill that have concerned House Democrats. Those changes would be made under budget reconciliation rules. Language in the Senate bill over abortion has proved to be a critical issue in gaining or losing House votes. Socially conservative Democrats don't like the abortion language in the Senate bill because it implies that people receiving government-subsidized health care can obtain an abortion. This week, Congressman Bart Stupak, a key Michigan Democrat and one of the most outspoken on banning abortion language, said he is willing to talk with House leaders this week to come to some understanding on wording that would impose no new limits on abortion rights, but also would not allow use of federal money for the procedure. Even with a few kinks still to be worked out, House leaders said they are in the home stretch of drafting the corrections bill, which will then be sent along with the Senate-passed health care bill to the Congressional Budget Office for a cost estimate. Perhaps by the end of this week.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Congressman John Dingell from Michigan's 15th District, the longest serving member in the House of Representatives and a champion for universal healthcare. Congressman, you were at the bipartisan televised summit President Obama held at the Blair House a few weeks ago. It clarified the differences between Republicans and Democrats and led to the president adding a few ideas offered by Republicans to his plan. Talk to us about the overall mood of the summit, and did it shift the tone of the national conversation?
Well, the conversation there was friendly, but it wound up with my Republican colleague saying that it was very friendly, nice, but it accomplished nothing. But as you know, the national conversation is one of the more obnoxious, in fact, probably the most obnoxious that I've heard in my career in the Congress. And the teabaggers and the others who are opposed to the president's bill are engaged in some of the most scandalous misbehavior I've ever seen in terms of their conduct in addressing the substance of the bill, and that goes as far as, quite frankly, outright lies about what the bill does. The death panels and the business of pulling the plug on grandmother would, quite frankly, reflect discredit on a scoundrel.
Congressman, after the summit on health care, you said that the last perfect legislation that was presented to mankind was delivered by Moses at the base of Mount Sinai and written in the fingers of God, which is a great quote. Now, that seems like a precursor to acknowledging that any bill that would be passed is likely to have some shortcomings. What are those shortcomings in your eyes?
Well, they're more the product of the inadequacies of the bill than they are in things that, in fact, are bad. For example, I don't like at all the idea that there is going to be a tax on plans. I think that that is going to be extremely counterproductive. I think that the absence of a public option, which may occur, but which I hope won't, is a calamitous difficulty, because it eliminates a meaningful, honest competitor in the national insurance market. I think the weaknesses that they're putting on the exchanges in some of the proposals are a very serious problem. You know, way back when I was a small boy, the Democrats came forward with a regulation of the securities industry. And the way they did it was to insist that securities be sold through exchanges, which were essentially self-regulatory bodies and which regulated then the markets. And they, in turn, the markets, NASDAQ, or then the CURB, and the New York Exchange and some of the others, were regulated by the SEC. It worked out well as long as we had honest regulators and people who understood the law and were willing to see to it was obeyed. Now, that ended when George Bush appointed Cox to be the chairman of the SEC, at which point everything went to hell in a handbasket. Mm-hmm. And the harsh fact of the matter is, without that, a major protection for consumers to see to it that proper behavior is conducted by the insurance companies and that they do, in fact, comply with the law is going to be extremely hard. Remember, insurance companies make their money in the fine print. And the policies are written by a batch of Philadelphia lawyers who care about one thing, and they're administered by a bunch of green, eye-shaded, flint-hearted appraisers who are looking to see how they can exclude the costs and the services that the insurance company should give to their insured. And that's the way they make their money. So you have to put in people who can do a good job. And regretfully, the states have never been able to address this question adequately. And I'm not satisfied that the federal government is going to be able to do so until this happens, because it's... As the old saying goes, the devil's in the details, and you can bet the devil's going to be having lots of time to write these insurance policies in the future to maximize the profits for the insurance companies and, quite frankly, to skin the insurance buyers.
We're speaking with Congressman John Dingell from Michigan's 15th District. We've been hearing a lot about Democrats rushing this bill through Congress. Republicans in the conservative talk shows have been using the phrase "ram down our throats" quite a bit in the last week, yet... We just passed the one year anniversary since the health reform debate started, and you've been in politics for a long time and know momentum is important to passing the legislation. Do you think the bill will be voted on before the Easter recess? And are you worried if it doesn't hit that target?
Well, I'm a legislator, not a prophet. And second of all, people who have been prophesying dates have always wound up with a red face. If you watched me, I have not. And I'm going to continue that record to avoid a red face. Now, having said these things, that comment by the Republicans ranks with what they've been saying about death panels and pulling the plug on grandma and taking away the choice from people and putting government in charge of health care. That's just plain raw, outright fiction, or at best, and at worst, it's just plain lies. The harsh fact of the matter is that they've had about 15 months during which they've been able to make all manner of trouble. They have slowed down everything around here, not only on health care, but on everything else they're doing. And if you go over the Senate, you'll find the Republicans are impeding movement of everything from the prayer to the motion to adjourn. And to be truthful with you, I don't think I could get the Lord's Prayer approved by the Senate without some kind of Republican filibuster.
Congressman, it seems to me that mostly we're hearing about what the House and the Senate, the Democrats or the Republicans, think about health reform lately. But there are an awful lot of Americans out there who it seems would benefit in a pretty short time if the bill passes. I'm thinking of the provisions that would make it possible for people with pre-existing conditions like cancer to buy coverage at affordable rates. And I think that goes into effect pretty quickly, maybe as soon as 90 days after the bill is signed into law. So where do you think the public is on this? Why aren't we hearing more publicly from people who might benefit from health reform?
The public is thoroughly befuddled, because all you're getting out of this place is a prof- profound deluge of falsehoods by my Republican colleagues. They are refusing to point out, for example, that pre-existing conditions can no longer bar you, your employer, or your family from insurance. That's something that is desperately needed by the insured public. Today, they can cancel your insurance policy while you're on the gurney being rolled into the operating room. Can't do that under this bill. And there are all kinds of other things. You have to have a right of appeal if they deny you benefits. You have to have policies which are written so that they're clear, so that the assured can know what he's getting and understand all those wonderful, fine, technical, fine print statements that enrich the insurance companies so gloriously. And there are a whole array of other things which will save money for the American public and desperately have to. One of the things that's going to be of enormous benefit is the fact that we have paid, since this legislation is introduced, about $51 billion in charges that the average citizen is paying for those who have no insurance policies.
Mm-hmm.
And that's skinning the American people. And if you want to look at another thing, which is of the most urgent concern, today the average premium for an ordinary employer insurance-sponsored family costs about $1,115 a month. That's $13,375. That's more than the yearly income of somebody working for a minimum wage job. Those numbers are going to expand to about $25,000, and in the case of employers, it'll be about $26,000 in about 10 years. Now, that means all manner of things are going to happen, and it means mostly it's going to be tremendous dropping of these insurance policies by employers who can no longer afford to make them available.
Congressman Dingell, all eyes are on the House of Representatives. Who are the remaining camps in the House that still need to be corralled, and what will you be doing to persuade those wavering Democrats?
Oh, balls of fire. I'd like to give you an answer on that. There are lots of them around, and if your listeners want to do something, they should write their congressman and insist they push this bill, whatever it is. Look, I'm a single-payer advocate. I believe that's the way that it should be done. It works in Britain. It works in France. It works in Germany. It works in Japan. It works in Canada. And the people there love it. The cost of their insurance goes up half as fast as ours. It's about 8% of the GDP. Here it's about 15, and it's headed for 20 in less than 10 years. We simply have to understand we have to do something about this, or it's going to destitute the whole country. And when a guy goes to bed, he hasn't got the vaguest idea whether he's going to have insurance when he wakes up in the morning.
You occupy the seat that was once held by your father, who was one of the architects of the New Deal and is famous, among other things, for introducing the National Health Insurance Bill, the Wagner-Murray-Dingell Bill. We've read a little bit about his personal story. Certainly, he was a passionate believer in universal health care as a social justice issue. So we have a question for you. If your father were here with us today, what would he say about the bill in front of us?
I think he'd see it about through the same prism that I see it. A good bill. It could be a whole heck of a lot better. But he understood that you've got to help people, and you can't strive for perfection. And as President Obama observed, the perfect must not be permitted to become the enemy of the necessary. Now, Dad used to say that perfection is always the enemy of the good.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, he'd say, for the sweet love of God, let's get out, get this bill passed so that we can head off a calamity that's coming at this country because of health care cost increases and because we're going to be taking care of the needs of 45 million or more people who have no health insurance. There's a million in Michigan who have none. This is bankrupting state governments. It's bankrupting cities. The cost increases are showing up in the taxes that people pay for real estate, because communities are going broke in this, and the cost of medicine is simply going to go up and up and up until we deal with it. The bill has a lot of things in it that are going to constrain cost, and such as moving towards health information technology throughout the whole system of healthcare. We're going to have insurance exchanges, perhaps not as good as I'd like, but they'll be there. And it's going to provide a mechanism for curbing excessive prices. You know, every day the insurance companies sit around and they figure out how they're going to increase prices, how they're going to reduce benefits, because that's how they make their money. And one of the interesting things that they're doing is figuring out how it is they're going to serve less and make more money, because that's, believe it or not, the way they're doing it. And one of the things that we have to confront with regard to our friendly insurance companies is the simple fact that 11 states have got insurance price increases before their regulatory bodies of as much as 59%. And I know nobody who can look me in the straight eye, including a Republican, and say that is justified by good conscience or economic necessity. And I don't know of anybody who is outside of an insane asylum say that they want that.
Today we've been speaking with Congressman John Dingell, the longest-serving member in the House of Representatives, a champion and a clarion voice on health care reform. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea focuses on fighting childhood obesity through community-based interventions. Somerville, Massachusetts, a town northwest of Boston, is the best-known example to date. Like many ethnically diverse urban cities across the United States, Somerville had a high rate of obesity and diabetes. Somerville also had the infrastructure that, with some small changes, could become an ideal urban space for healthy living. The effort began as a community-based research study at Tufts University for overweight first through third graders in the Somerville public schools. The project called Shape Up Somerville went on to introduce healthy eating in collaboration with the introduction of more physical activity. Shape Up Somerville worked with Somerville School Food Service Department to enhance the quality and quantity of healthy foods for students. Schools now purchase locally grown produce for their school lunches, and school gardens help familiarize children with the different vegetables. Parents and community members are engaged through a newsletter with updates on the project, healthy tips, and coupons for healthy foods. The results, posted on the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University website, found that the project reduced the weight of kids who were overweight or at risk of becoming overweight. The research has since grown into a citywide campaign. Somerville now has two community gardens and a farmers market. It even launched two community-supported agricultural sites where residents can purchase shares of nearby farmers' crops. Changes have also been made in restaurants to offer things like smaller portions and more visible nutritional labeling. The Somerville project has become an example of a community rather than an individual fighting for a healthier society. In her recent campaign to fight obesity, First Lady Michelle Obama identified Somerville as a national leader, citing local practices to be used in a national model. Several communities across the country have begun testing whether they can replicate Somerville's success, a small community experiment that has now become a national standard for fighting childhood obesity. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.